Ernest Morton, Real Four. So you're now in the chocolate business, making bit... Is it... Am I right in bitter chocolate? Yes. With your aunt and uncle and living in Golders Green. Yes, is that right? Yes.
And I've got a little house with rent. And, I mean, I knew about it. What much did you do? Nothing. It wasn't much to know. It was the mechanical things you had to do. And we started about 7 o'clock in the morning, finished any time, 10 to 11 at night, you see. Saturday I was allowed to go out.
Was it a sort of wholesalers? Did they then...
What happened? It was a suburban house. They used the kitchen as a place where they... what really happened, they bought the chocolate from Lindt. Very good chocolate. Bitter chocolate. Melted it in a special... container, especially built for that, you see, very, very expensive, very nice. You melt it. Then, for instance, I give you an article which the Queen got from us. He had a very good, very good connection. He got a very good connection, not me. And she dipped this, she had the chocolate in, let's say, truffles. You prepare first the concept of the truffles, which is cream, which is melted. Mix this chocolate and put vanilla in or something like this, and sugar if necessary, but so depends on your taste. And then we had that sort of little 20, 40, 50 little round thing of that size. And then they dipped into melted chocolate very carefully. I couldn't do it, she did it because they just careful and put it on another plate. When it was dry, it was delicious chocolate. Bitter with a sweet truffle in the middle. Only the best of the ingredients was the excellent cream, excellent milk, excellent thing, and it was comparatively expensive. A pound of this truffle cost, I can tell you, 4 shillings. That's enormous. And rich immigrants suffered very much that they couldn't get the same food in England as they could get in Germany. And chocolate was very important for some of them. And they bought any bit of anything to get this. Nobody else had this chocolate, you see. But we got that. You run out in a car, in a Ford car, delivered it, you see. And then people recommended it to others. And it was very cumbersome because we could only sell the chocolate we produced, you see. So my aunt and I were reminded tonight to do this and that. And he was very inventive. And he was very, very clever at this. She was quite a primitive woman, really. She had been, her father had been very orthodox and doing very sort of under this. And she worked, she knew nothing about anything really apart from work. She absorbed brilliantly, I must say. And she was heroic, she worked if necessary 7 days a week, every day 12 hours, 13 hours, you see. Couldn't get dressed for dresses, anything, she was determined to survive, you see. And from nothing. While I was there for about 2.5 years. She built up, but I got them the Royal Mammy, a freeboard. It's quite cold. Food was very good. I had a very tiny little room. And 5 shillings a week. Which was not a fortune. 5 shillings a week was more than, was more or less similar, probably £10 a week. So it was a difference. And I couldn't get out anyhow.
What was happening with your visa situation?
I mean, as you gather, I didn't go back to Germany. See, I decided not to go back to Germany. Now, my uncle's that you get a permit to stay here and to work as a trainee. That's a lot of trainees sometimes, you know. If you could say to them, I want to stay for a year to learn them a chocolate and then I go to Timbuktu, right? That could work, you see? This is the luck of the game. That's it, would, as long as you weren't going to stay there and you weren't taking anybody else's money away, I mean, of course, I didn't earn anything in the eyes, I just stayed with my uncle. So we went to a lawyer, and the lawyer made an application to the home office. And after that, long after my permit had expired, I was only there to work for me for 4 weeks, I got a letter from the home office. I've got it, so I can show it to you. That they have to tell, please tell your client, Henry, that he is not allowed to stay here. is that you should make arrangements to leave within the next 24 hours. So, now by that time, if I would have gone back to Germany, if I told my mother, if you speak, first of all, forget now that in the meantime, everything has become much, much worse in Germany, very much worse.
Yes, what date are we now talking about?
We're talking now about the beginning of June, you see. Right. And at that time, once you came back to Germany, after having been abroad for a certain time, they put you immediately in concentration camps because they didn't want people to say how nice their foreign countries was. You see, they wanted you were affected by the having been out of Germany. So you were put them away. I knew that. And I was really, between you and me, quite determined if I would not get, I would have jumped on the boat. I wouldn't have, going back there and being, I knew already it was very bad. Was pretty much worse, you know, which I didn't know, you see. I didn't see no other solution. So, what you did normally was you made another application to the Home Office and sent your passport with it. This was very important because, meantime, the Home Office may have instructed the police to arrest you and to deport you. But if you had no passport, you had to get a passport back from the but this was all very cumbersome. This was not, they were very inefficient in that. You can take them 3 weeks before you get the passport back, or they might mislay it if you're lucky, you see. So that was all calculated. So what happened then in the end? In the end, yes, they gave me I could go back to the Jews. They said to me, by the way, if you stay here, you will know nothing for you. You will not anything. The only chance you have, you should go back to Germany and then come back. Apply for a visa and come back again. I mean, that was bad. So I'd forgotten about that. It's useless, you see. So I could only pray that I would go out of the test for all access. And it was like that. It was like backward and forward and forward and backward.
What was your state of mind like, Ernest, at this? You know, was it a very anxious time for you?
Yes, I was very, very anxious. But I tried not to think much about it because I couldn't do much about it, you see. And I didn't like my environment. I couldn't stand this woman who was there. It was awful. My uncle was indifferent. He was neither bad or good. And he had to live with her, and he was very thankful for her because he would have been starving without her. She was very hard working, but she was very clever. You know, she was really, she put a lot of beautiful chocolate as herself. There was a lady Swiss, I think Swiss are still in existence. They are so Jewish aristocracy, bank and so on, very, very, very high ranking. And Lady Swiss, I never met her, she found out about our chocolate, and she had every month a morning party, on which society there, all the societies there. And she had those little things all over the place with our chocolate. And they also just a delicious chocolate, and she gave our address to them, and they phoned and ordered some. And then one of her closest friends was Queen Mary, Queen Mother, and she loved it, you see. And she asked Katie's faithfully from time to time to get her some. Half a pound, you see. Everybody bought a pound, but half a pound was. 1 pound was too expensive, you see, because the woman was half a pound, that's what happy with, you see.
I think we ought to go back to the story about the visa, though,
yes.
Isn't it? Because you're on the planet.
Some were a sort of compromise solution that they would, allow me, I don't want to say, but that time, because the whole picture had changed, you know, it was completely different. So I think at that time they were willing to give me another, I think, 6 months or 7 months to stay here and then emigrate. But that was a compromise solution. And when the year ended, by then time, there were so many refugees here, and these people who had spoken to me were not part anymore. There were really so dozens of people working, trying to do what the others did, and two or three people come from concentration camps. It was
the end of the year, of course, Kristallnacht would have happened. Did you hear anything of that?
Yes, all in the papers, you see.
Was it? Was it covered?
Yes, it was sensational. That was, you see, this was after he had invaded, not invaded, had gone into Austria. The Austrian celebrated him as a liberated, you see, I mean, taught the best. And from that day onwards, when he saw there was no reaction by the other countries about it, he then had to come. Then he did what he really wanted to do.
Yes, but you know, from your own experience, Kristallnacht, did that increase the flow of refugees?
Yes,
was that,
yes,
you
yes.
know, the effect of that?
Probably recently, I heard about it from somebody, what I tell you now, only at the time I met one of the, I met when I was on the street in London, you always met now refugees, you knew, from Berlin or something like this, or acquaintances and people like this. And one of them told me, after Kristallnacht, they queued up before the British office in hundreds and thousands, and in the sort of American office. And there was, this chap told me, there was an official, when he got in, he said, I wanted to have a work around, I wanted to have a visa for England, he automatically a visa. And he saved 20,000 people. And that I felt was all rubbish. You see, you have so many rumors. I said, it's very interesting. I didn't take a CS. And I told it a German friend to me about 3 months ago about this chap. And he had never heard of it. You see, I said, you heard all these rumors, the six sentences. And would you believe it? A week later, it was announced on the news, it was now released, that a former consul in Berlin gave visas to everybody. He was a high ranking member of the British Secret Service in the First World War and the Second World War, and he decided on his own just to get the visas. And the ambassador thought he had a structure for London because he knew he was a Secret Service agent, and there was some reason for it. Totally his invention. And this only came out recently because some of the people we saved went to Israel and said, he's dead now, he should have a memorial for what he did, which they gave him. And there's now a book out about this, you see, great detail. He was brilliant. He was in the first his book, he was a screwball.
Yes, I better not, you know, people can, you've given the clue, so I think people can follow. It's really your own experience, Ernest, we're interested in. And I wonder, did you hear from your mother at this time?
Yes. My mother on the Kristallnacht, I should have done clearly, but I couldn't do it with my uncle because he saved every penny. She phoned me from Berlin, see, to reassure me, you see. But of course she phoned because hoping they knew she was phoning England, you see. So if it happened, they would go careful, you see, because they always try to deny everything, you see. When it's also somebody spoke from Berlin to London, avoid it, would avoid it. I don't know whether it could have happened that way, but I think they did, as I said.
But what did she tell you? No, what had happened?
That she was all right. Nothing further, because she assumed already. I said, yes, we've heard it. It was in the evening papers, you see, everywhere. It was headlines, actually, at that time. And the Germans, some of the Germans were very shocked about it. They were being forgotten. And that was a turning point, really. That was the end, beginning of the end, you see. Because they got away again. Nobody said anything. It's like Yugoslavia, you see. It's people just tried to sort of settle down again. And then, of course, in April invaded Czechoslovakia after having told that he wouldn't because he was in peace with us. It's just the
but
same
how, you know, your own situation at this time, which is really what we're interested in. After Kristallnacht, was your, you know, were you getting worried about your permit again, this 6 month business?
I waited and knew that things were now moving so rapidly. It was unlikely that he would deport me, you see. That I think I felt instinctively would unlikely to happen unless I had committed a crime or something like this. Another crime, I have committed one crime by saying to the official I was here as a guest, you see. I mean, that was not correct, but listen, I knew it. There was no other choice for me, you see. And then came the 1st of September, Hitler attacked Poland. I went to the same office which had thrown me out, and there were quite a number of other people of my age who always asked whether we could join the British Army. And they took lists of the names that they felt that. And they thought, anyhow, it would create a good impression with the home office and so on, that the people are willing to do that. I said, I never thought that we would join. I mean, the Germans, you see, they never understood the whole situation of the authorities. Found it very difficult to associate, to understand this facility. We say Jews, and they say Jews, and they talk German, and for us, we were Germans. Full stop, right? And sometimes it's that we should have been interned as Germans, you see. So totally disinterested in the concentration camp and so on, didn't know what it seemed, I'd never read a paper, they were typical civil servants. Now I appeared, my uncle appeared a day before I did, before a tribunal in Godderscreen.
This would have been on the 1st of September?
No, that happened actually in October, 2 months later.
So war had been declared?
On the 3rd of
September. Yes, tell me about that, you know, the declaration of war.
Yes, I listened to it on the radio and listened to Mr. Chamberlain, and I was from the end, in spite of my mother being there, because it still said to mother what lives there. You see, I mean, it, nobody for a minute would have, I mean, anybody would have had the idea that he would kill us in the end, and he would have seen me as he's mad. You see, I mean, it's totally idiotic. And my mother knew it would be difficult, my mother knew it would be very unpleasant. He then was put into armament. You see, she worked in armament. What she did, I never knew, of course, because she had never worked in her life in that way. You see. But she was put up in a doctor, she would probably put some screwing or something like this, I don't know. And all I knew that that now with Jews in Germany, they would have a very difficult time, but nobody thought that what was happening would happen. So that was that was more worried as there was no bombing, of course. We didn't attack Berlin. We didn't. The war went on, and the Germans won the war. You see.
You had applied to Woburn House and put your name on a list,
yes,
volunteering for the British Army. Did anything come of that?
Nothing. And then I have to tell you what happened afterwards, which is really very important. You know, we have to appear before a tribunal. And I happened to appear on my own. My relatives have been here before, and of course were exempted from any restrictions. And now I came and was interviewed by one man to the tribunal, three people, was only one. Men who were very imposing came in, the police and the police people, and they waited for the person to interview me. And you were immediately aware that he was a very strong and very interesting personality. And when he came in, the police jumped up and saluted him. He was in civilian clothes. He came in. And he said, you realize that you're here illegal. First of all, ask me about the Nazis. And say, what do you think about this? And this Nazi, and say, sorry, I'm not Nazi, I'm a Jew, yes, I know what you say. But wouldn't you think if you had a chance, you might have been a Nazi? I said, no, I don't think I've ever been a Nazi. But I know some people would have done it. So he spoke quite a while about the political side, as it was me. And he felt he knew very much, very much. And he was half amused with this little boy that was sitting to him and talking about politics. And he half sort of mocked me, but in a friendly way, not in an unfriendly way. And I said, by the way, yes, you are the nephew of the people who do chocolate for Queen Mary. I said, yes. It's irony. What would you do if I didn't intern you? I said, I tried to join the army on the first day when Hitler marched into Poland, and I have not heard anything about it. So, I would like to join the army because I think it's very important. And I said, I've got news. He said to me, I've got good news for you. From today, you can join the army. And then was the thing you had to say normally when the police interrogated you. When they ask you, do you want to stay in Britain? You had to say, to the police, no, I want only temporarily. I want to go to Australia or China, anywhere. But I have to see for the time being. That was the correct answer. But when the war started, I was told by other refugees, don't say that, because it seems you are not loyal. So you have to say, I want to stay in Britain, which I did. He nodded very vigorously. So he gave me his stamp. Nazi refugee exempted from all restrictions. Half the short course. He was later on the prosecutor at Nuremberg.
What date was your tribunal? Do you remember?
October 1939. And a week later, 2 weeks later, I was in the Christmas rush in Oxford Street near St. Richard's. And suddenly, Harvey Shuttleworth stood in front of me. I walked in front of me. I turned towards me by chance. And he was home on Christmas. And immediately recognized me and waved to me, which I thought was very nice. So, as you say, strange, where he was living, and I knew he knew, and I found out he was brought up in Dresden, and his father was a professor in Dresden. That's why he knew everything about the Nazis, you see. He was word stiff, and he found it quite amusing, and I could feel he was friendly, he wasn't nasty, you see.
Whereabouts was that, your tribunal? Where was it?
In Gunnersgrün. Because there were hundreds of refugees, you see. He was brought stiff because he could hold their story better than he could, you see. So that was very, very funny. And he was later on the man who condemned the going of these people, you see. It's very impressive because he's now over 90.
So could you tell me then about joining the British Army? Where were you sent? What were the initial moves?
I got in December, the letter that I had to appear in Bloomsbury. So in the meantime, to the Jewish refugee, I had moved into a hotel, huge place in Bloomsbury, because they were in charge of all the German refugees. These were quite a number of thousands. And we were assembling there to be taken by lorry, by bus, the station and to be sent to a camp. It was a terrible cold winter, by the way, so we went there and hundreds of other refugees of all ages and to this camp, to went to the station and went to Richboro, which is really near Sandwich, you know, in Kent. And it would have been a former prisoner of war camp in the First World War, and then converted into a camp for refugees. And we started there. This was, in some ways, even more amused than frightened, because it was very, very, very relaxed. And we had them ready to give us a uniform, which my great regret, I didn't get my uniform in the first year, I still had to run 24 hours in my civil things. We were all very eager, we were to get into this. And we got our uniform, then we had to give an oath. That was very, very, very informal. We had somebody, we had a chair in the middle, we put our hand on this chair, and somebody said out, I'm going to be loyal to this, and we have completed this, and let's finish this of oath. and then we were British soldiers, and we were all refugees, most of German together, of all ages. And the people were there, sort of like cattle. Sorted out people. There's two or three regiments we had to fill in the three regiments. The people who were in charge of the regiment selected the people they wanted to have. The soldiers said they didn't know anything about us. And I saw the chap who selected one people, and he looked familiar to me. He was already a sergeant. And I suddenly recognized he had been in my school, but he was a bit older than me. And I was with another person from my school, but he was much older. And I said to him, Peter, you know this chap? No, he was in our school. So when he, this chap, who was a journalist, he was very sophisticated, was a very interesting man himself. And when he saw this chap that was obviously important, he went to him and said, you remember me and this in the school? He said, no, you know the school. He said, I was there. And he was most delighted to have found somebody who went to school. And then he introduced me to me, he had forgotten me. He had spoken to me, went on a every morning to school, he was behind me before me, both of me, this chair. And when he spoke to me, it was a terrible bore, because they were very wealthy, told me about his butler, which I wasn't very much interested as a communist, you can even imagine. So, but he was quite friendly, and he couldn't remember anything. But he was delighted that he came to the school.
What sort of training did you have?
I'll tell you in a minute. The training consisted that we were marching up and down to learn to march. And this was really our main training. So, say, that was very harmless. And this was all because we didn't have any weapons. We were really nothing else but cheap labor to look after or whatever you had to look after, you see. And there were two, and it was quite interesting to a certain extent. There were four regiments being prepared to go out, and three were within a very short time in France, and did some offloading and loading of food transports, etc., and were used to sort of generally unfit labor, you see. And one was here, I don't know, selected to go to Donington in Shropshire, which was one of the leading camps of the Royal Engineers who had equipment. Maybe not about that much. This particular camp, which we were the first, there's still in existence, a very big camp. We looked after water supply to support, to supply to the various camps so that they had their own water supply, showers and everything. And all over the world, we sent it. It's on a gigantic scale. And after 2 days there in Birmingham, after 3 weeks training, which I told you was nothing, really, nothing at all, but marching, I took over there, put nothing else to do with us. And we either had no weapons, but if they had weapons, they couldn't give them to us. We didn't want weapons either. We were quite happy that we are not combatant unit. Is it right? So, of course, once we realized that this was more or less our training, I remember, certainly, I had not thought about it actually all the time. When, before I left Germany, I went to one of the centers of German training, one of the very big places, and some of them were former school friends of mine, and said, come on, look at what they're doing, it's interesting. We still thought of, not of the war, it was like playing soldiers. So they showed us first of all the equipment and the weapons, and then they showed us how they were trained. And as a training, which was more for acrobats, they were to do all sorts of things. And I was very impressed and so very efficient, very much. I was pretty detached. I never saw all the things that happened, which didn't happen, even with my latest pessimism. And it was very impressive. And when I was in the British Army, it was just like a passing holiday camp, didn't get your uniforms on. I thought, of course, we are really non-combatant units, this is just what it is. Later on, we found out it was much different in the other places, either because of the short of ammunition or of weapons, really. And when they had weapons, they got old-fashioned rifles, some of them from the First World War. And then there were some troops, of course, which were specially trained, but it was in the beginning, it was afterwards, really. It's changed after the Dunkirk War, so enormously. But at that time, this was still the fully war period, of course, you see. So, all I knew, that the NCOs were all the retired soldiers who had been in the First World War, so they were allowed to look after us. And a sprinkling of refugees were promoted, like this teacher from our school, who was already a sergeant, became a quartermaster sergeant, and then the head sergeant ended up as a colonel, by the way. But this was much later. So we went to Donington, and we quite liked it. And then I liked it even more when, through my connection to the quartermaster sergeant, I got immediately a very cushy job, you see, and corruption. And I looked after the water supply, the water supply instruments, which I had never seen in my life before. So it was very easy to get to know them.
You were saying these were for all the all over the fighting zone they were going to?
Everywhere, overseas.
Yes, well, what sort of equipment was it, Ernest? Could
really
you tell me?
Basically, from taps to showers to everything you need in a camp if you want to keep them nice and clean.
Yes, so it was more for sort of hygiene, was it? And
yes.
And drinking water?
Nothing this water, to do, could have been used for any youth camp and so on, you know. And it was very good quality, very interesting. And I learned after a few weeks all the names of this. You see, those all names which I never heard of before. And we got an evening, it's like in a business, we got a sheet, please, tomorrow, and we had a huge, like a station, lots of different trains would come in, you see, and we would then, would be told, have this and this ready to be loaded on the track number 3, there's a 4, you see. And I had the manpower, I was in charge of 2 hours, we all run it together, you see. And after 2 days, we ran it very well, and once they found out we did it very well, they gave us more and more. We were in the people who run it, they were Royal Engineers, And once they found out we did it very well, they did other things. They tended and they had a nice time. We were very pleased that we did it efficiently without them.